And for the rest of us, why don't you turn to the book of Zephaniah? So this is the ninth minor prophet in the Old Testament. We are coming near to the end of going through all 12 minor prophets. And so the book of Zephaniah is where we're going to be for the next 3 weeks. We'll kind of spend 3 weeks in Zephaniah, and then it'll be Christmas already, which is just crazy. But Zephaniah chapter 1 is where we'll be this morning. And so by way of just some context and background, if you look at verse 1 of chapter 1, this is what it says. The word of the Lord that came to Zephaniah, the son of Cushi, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Amon, king of Judah. So, verse 1 gives us a ton of background information that helps us frame up when the book of Zephaniah was written and what was going on at Judah in Judah at the time. And if you've been with us through, you know, all of these previous eight minor prophets, we always want to ask, well, who was this originally given to? What was going on in the nation at that time? Because it helps us make sense of some of the words that we're going to study and read together. So, first of all, what's super interesting is that Zephaniah gives four generations of family history. And you have to know that that is very odd. It's not normal. Zephaniah, he says, you know, Zephaniah, son of Cushi, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah. So he goes back to his great-great-grandfather. Now that's really unique among the prophetic books of the Old Testament. Eight of the prophets don't even give any family history. We know nothing about them. Six of the prophets give simply the name of their father. And then Zechariah is the only other prophet that gives his father and his grandfather. But here we have Zephaniah. He goes back four generations. So you kind of go, well, why? Why is he doing that? Most scholars believe that Zephaniah does this to point out the fact that there is actually royalty in his family tree. Hezekiah, so Zephaniah's great-great-grandfather, is most likely King Hezekiah, who was one of the good kings of Judah. And so if you know the history of Israel, I think there's something like 40 kings between Israel and Judah, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And probably, and don't quote me, but it's something like less than half a dozen, five or six kings that were really good, and the rest were awful. And so the cycle would go bad king, bad king, bad king, bad king, good king, bad king, bad king, bad king, bad king, good king. And so Hezekiah, Zephaniah's great-great-grandfather, was one of the good kings of Judah. And what he did is he attempted to reform and turn the hearts of the people back to God. And so what Zephaniah is doing is he's telling us that he comes from that family line. So not only is he a prophet, but he's got royalty in his lineage. He would have been a cousin of King Josiah, who was reigning at the time. So also in verse 1, like I said, we're told that Zephaniah prophesied during the reign of King Josiah, his cousin. And King Josiah reigned in Judah from 640 to 609 BC. And if you know the story about Josiah, he becomes king when he's 8 years old. Like, my daughter's seven, and I'm like, what? How on earth is that possible? But they make him king when he's 8. And in 622 BC, so like 18 years into his kingship, they find the book of the law, most likely Deuteronomy, and Josiah reads the book of the law, and he realizes the sin and idolatry and wickedness going on, and he attempts to reform and turn the nation back to God. He destroys idols, he restores temple worship, he reinstates the Passover, and all in this attempt to turn people from their sin back to God. Now, this is why the book of Zephaniah is somewhat puzzling, because we ask, well, was this written before Josiah's reforms or after? Like, if the nation of Judah was reforming, right, and getting rid of idols and turning back to God, then why would Zephaniah pronounce judgment on them? So there's a couple of clues that help us figure out when Zephaniah probably prophesied. And I believe that he prophesied after the reforms of Josiah had already begun. We know that Zephaniah prophesied before the fall of Nineveh that happened in 612 BC because Zephaniah actually predicts that in his book. And Zephaniah, you're going to notice in these next three chapters, he quotes the book of Deuteronomy extensively, like a lot. And so this leads scholars to believe that Zephaniah probably prophesied after the book of Deuteronomy had been found. Josiah finds the book of Deuteronomy, and Zephaniah quotes from Deuteronomy extensively, probably reminding people, think about what we just found in the book of the law. So most scholars think that Zephaniah prophesied after Josiah had already begun his reforms. So what that tells us then is, you know, Josiah, he's beginning to tear down idols, he's restoring the temple, but what we have to get is that those reforms didn't have the widespread impact that the king had hoped. Perhaps Josiah's changes were actually more superficial than we realize, right? Because I think I had this picture in my mind that when Josiah was doing this, the entire nation turned back to God, and that's actually just not true. Most of the nation was so steeped in idolatry and wickedness that it was as if they were too far gone. Because according to Zephaniah, we're going to read, there was social injustice, there was rampant luxury at the expense of the poor, there was Baal worship, all of these things were still going on in Judah, despite the fact that Josiah was trying to get the people to turn back. And if you read in 2 Kings 23, King Josiah is killed in 609 BC in battle, and his son Jehoahaz reigns, and you ask yourself this, how long did it take for Judah to get right back to the sin and idolatry and wickedness that they had been doing? 3 months. So you go, okay, this was not long-lasting heart change. Less than 3 months later, they're back to doing even worse than they were before. So I think that even though Josiah had a heart for the Lord, and he did his absolute best to turn the nation back to God, the people of Judah were too far gone. They were too entrenched in idolatry. And so what we have here in this book is that in the midst of an attempted spiritual reform, Zephaniah the prophet brings the word of the Lord to the people. So verse 2, this is what he says. I will utterly sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. Like, welcome to church. Isn't that good? I'm going to just wipe out everything, God says. Verse 3, I will sweep away man and beast. I will sweep away the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea and the rubble with the wicked. I will cut off mankind from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And I will cut off from this place the remnant of Baal and the name of the idolatrous priests along with the priests. Those who bow down on the roofs to the host of the heavens, those who bow down and swear to the Lord and yet swear by Milcom, those who have turned back from following the Lord, who do not seek the Lord or inquire of him. Be silent before the Lord God, for the day of the Lord is near. The Lord has prepared a sacrifice and consecrated his guests. And on the day of the Lord's sacrifice, I will punish the officials and the king's sons and all who array themselves in foreign attire. On that day I will punish everyone who leaps over the threshold and those who fill their master's house with violence and fraud. On that day, declares the Lord, a cry will be heard from the fish gate, a wail from the second quarter, a loud crash from the hills. Wail, O inhabitants of the mortar, for all the traitors are no more, all who weigh out silver are cut off. At that time I will search Jerusalem with lamps, and I will punish the men who are complacent, those who say in their hearts, the Lord will not do good, nor will he do ill. Their goods shall be plundered and their houses laid waste. Though they build houses, they shall not inhabit them. Though they plant vineyards, they shall not drink wine from them. The great day of the Lord is near, near and hastening fast. The sound of the Lord is bitter. The mighty men cries aloud there, a day of wrath is that day, a day of distress and anguish, a day of ruin and devastation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet blast and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the lofty battlements. I will bring distress on mankind so that they shall walk like the blind because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out like dust and their flesh like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them on the day of the wrath of the Lord. In the fire of his jealousy, all the earth shall be consumed, for a full and sudden end he will make of all the inhabitants of the earth. The reading of God's word. So you're going to need to stick with me for the next 3 weeks, because chapter 1 really paints the bad news of God's judgment. Chapter 2 then gives the Israelites, and us for that matter, a glimmer of hope. And then chapter 3 ends with just this beautiful picture of God's restoration. But if you give up at chapter 1, well, then you never get to the good news of chapter 2 and chapter 3. So there is a lot already in this first chapter. But one thing we need to make sense of before we unpack it is this concept of the day of the Lord. The prophet Zephaniah uses the expression, the day of the Lord, more than any other prophet in the Bible. And there's different iterations of it. He'll say the day of the Lord, or a day, or the day, and different kind of variations of it. But he uses this concept of the day of the Lord more than any other prophet in the Bible. And so we need to ask then, okay, well, what is the day of the Lord? And I think most of us, when we hear that phrase, our minds immediately go to Armageddon, right? Or the apocalypse, like the end of the world. The day of the Lord is, you know, when God comes and everything's over, right? And it's like game over, end of the world, your time's up. I think most of us, when we hear of the day of the Lord, that's where our mind first goes to. But biblically speaking, the day of the Lord is a way to describe a coming manifestation of God in which God demonstrates his power in judgment, but also in rescue. So it's this, really, the day of the Lord is when God comes in judgment, but also in rescue. The first time that this kind of thinking is used is with the Exodus. Now, the phrase, the day of the Lord, is not used there, but all Israelites called the Exodus from Egypt the day. And it was this day when, right, God came in judgment on Egypt, and then God rescued his people from Egypt. And so that was called the day, this great day when God showed up and he punished an evil nation and he saved his people. So then the Israelites, all throughout their history, had this idea that there would be another day of the Lord, and it would be much the same, when God would come in judgment against their enemies, and then God would save his people as his own. So the first time that the phrase day of the Lord is used, it's in the book Amos. The prophet Amos, chronologically, he's the first one to use that. But here's what's fascinating. In Amos chapter 5, he says to the Israelites, why are you excited about the day of the Lord? Right? Because they would, hey, the day of the Lord, it's going to be like Egypt. God's going to come against Assyria and Babylon and save us as his people. And Amos says in Amos chapter 5, you Israelites should not be excited about the day of the Lord. Why? Because God's coming against you. And Israel went, but wait, the day of the Lord, God comes against his enemies. And all the prophets said, exactly, you are God's enemy now because of your wickedness and idolatry. So I want to draw this for us, because I think it'll really help us understand when we read prophetic books of the Bible. Because here's the danger. We often read prophetic books of the Bible and we say, well, it's all about Armageddon. It's all describing a future day, when by and large, much of it is not describing a future day. So this is the best explanation I heard of the day of the Lord. If you can imagine, you're looking at a mountain range, kind of head on. So don't laugh at my drawing. I'm a really good artist. There's a mountain, right? If you want some like snow, beautiful. And so let's say I'm looking at a mountain, and there very well might be, you know, another mountain. And if I'm looking at it head on, I would see this big looming mountain, and then I would see this closer mountain. Now, if you were to kind of change your perspective then, look at this mountain range from the side view, it very well could be, okay, there's that mountain, and here's this mountain that I see, and now that I'm looking at it from the side, oh, okay, there's like four other mountains in between that I couldn't see before. So when we hear the Bible use the phrase, the day of the Lord, one scholar said there is like a capital D day of the Lord, when God comes once and finally to deal with all wickedness and all sin and all rebellion. That would be the return of Jesus. And yet throughout history, there have been multiple days of the Lord that have taken place, where God manifests his power to judge a nation and sometimes to rescue his people. So the Exodus was a day of the Lord. When God wipes out Assyria, that is a day of the Lord. When God wipes out Babylon, that's a day of the Lord. When God wipes out the northern kingdoms of Israel, all the prophets said, the day of the Lord is coming. And for them, that was Israel being wiped out. And now Zephaniah is saying, the day of the Lord is near. He's not talking about the apocalypse. He's talking about Babylon is coming, guys. That's the day of the Lord. Because even think about some of the wording that is used. It can't possibly be talking about the second coming of Jesus. A cry will be heard from the fish gate, a wail from the second quarter. This is in verse 10 and 11. Wail, O inhabitants of the mortar. Those were neighborhoods in Jerusalem. And Zephaniah is saying, there's going to be wailing in those neighborhoods. And what happened when Nebuchadnezzar came? He wiped out the fish gate, the second quarter, the mortar. He systematically did exactly what was described. And yet, listen, this is really key. And yet there is wording that is used that you go, that seems so much bigger than just Babylon coming, right? That God's wiping out everything on earth. Well, you go, okay, Zephaniah is prophesying in the shadow of the great day of the Lord, and yet what he is describing is Babylon coming against Israel. And so what we see with all of these days of the Lord, whether it's the Exodus or Babylon or Assyria or the crucifixion of Jesus is the day of the Lord, what it does is it moves the storyline of God's redemption down the field, so to speak, for lack of a better term. Like, does that make sense? So this is the context when Zephaniah stands up and he's proclaiming the day of the Lord to the Judeans. I firmly believe he is not thinking about the return of Jesus. He's saying the day of the Lord is near, like within 20 years, people. Wake up, right? The day of the Lord is coming. Babylon is going to destroy us. So that's why when we read prophetic books of the Bible, we have to have that in view, because there's certain things that the prophets say that we go, well, that doesn't sound like that's happened already. And it's probably because they're prophesying within the shadow of this great day of the Lord that is coming. And yet there's specific things that we go, well, that's already happened, because that day of the Lord has already taken place. So even if you go to verses 2 and 3 kind of set the stage for the seriousness of what's going on. And God uses grand, apocalyptic, end-of-the-world type language. He says, I will utterly sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will sweep away man and beast. I will sweep away the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea and the rubble with the wicked. I will cut off mankind from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. So, I mean, that is quite an opening statement. Basically, God says, I'm just going to destroy everything. So, again, keep that in mind, right? Did God destroy everything when Babylon came? Well, no, right? It's this grand apocalyptic type language to describe the coming of God. And really, verses 2 and 3 are quite interesting. It's a reversal of the creation narrative that's found in Genesis chapter 1. Because God says in verses 2 and 3, he's going to sweep away man, beast, birds, and fish. And in the creation narrative in Genesis 1, the order is the opposite. God creates fish, then birds, then beasts, and lastly, mankind. So what Zephaniah is saying is that God is coming, and he's basically going to uncreate everything. Isn't that amazing? It's a reversal of creation. It's this picture of God's good, ordered world descending back into darkness and chaos. So then the question is, well, why? Why is God coming against Judah? Right? Why is Zephaniah pronouncing this day of the Lord a day of darkness and gloom and wrath? Like, why is God going to raise up Babylon to come and conquer Judah? And I think in chapter 1, we see three reasons why God is doing this. So the first reason is the people of Judah, God's people, were patronizing him. So look at these verses, verses 4 and 5. I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off from this place the remnant of Baal and the name of the idolatrous priests along with the priests, those who bow down on the roofs to the host of the heavens, those who bow down and swear to the Lord and yet swear by Milcom. Verses 8 and 9 even, on the day of the Lord's sacrifice, I will punish the officials and the king's sons and all who array themselves in foreign attire. On that day, I will punish everyone who leaps over the threshold and those who fill their master's house with violence and fraud. So what I mean by patronizing God is that the Israelites were worshiping God alongside worshiping a whole host of other false gods. So really, that's idolatry, essentially. The Israelites were told they're bowing down on the roofs to the hosts of heaven. So that would have been the Assyrian and the Canaanite deities. You know, they would worship stars and planets and the moon and all of these astral things. Those who bow down and swear to the Lord, right? So they're still going to the temple and they're still worshiping Yahweh, but then they're going home and they're worshiping Milcom and they're worshiping all the stars and the planets. So really, what we're seeing is that they're covering their bases, right? Yeah, we'll worship you, Yahweh. But just to be safe, we're also going to worship other gods. Right? Just think about that. I'll go to the temple, and I'll make a sacrifice, and I'll worship God. But then I'm going to go home, and at night, I'm going to go on my roof, and I'm going to worship the stars as well. Even in verses 8 and 9, you see syncretism has set in. That means that the Israel had borrowed customs and practices from other nations and adopted them as their own. Verse 8 says that they're adorning themselves in foreign attire. So they even adopted dressing like the foreign nations around them. Like, I don't know if you remember when God saved Israel from Egypt, what did he say to them? I want you to be different than all the other nations, right? I want you to be set apart. I don't want you to resemble all these other nations. I want you to be different and holy and set apart. And like even early on, what did the Israelites say? We want a king because we want to be like all the other nations, right? And now they're even dressing like all of these foreign nations. They've just adopted all of these customs and practices. Verse 9, God says that he's going to punish everyone who leaps over the threshold. And you go, well, what does that mean? And that's actually quite an interesting Philistine practice, which you can read about in 1 Samuel chapter 5. If you remember, the Ark of the Covenant was stolen by the Philistines and they put it in their temple. And then a couple times in a row, their God was kind of face down, had fallen over in front of the Ark. And this is what it says. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon, that's the Philistine God, had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. See, there was this superstition that arose in Philistine, among the Philistines. And what they would do is they would not walk across the threshold, so they would jump over the threshold because there was this superstitious practice. And what you see is Israel starts doing that, right? Let's jump over our thresholds in our houses and in the temple. And so God says, what are you doing? I'm going to punish anyone who jumps or leaps over the threshold who takes Philistine superstition and kind of adopts that as your own. So just think about this. The Israelites would worship God, but then also worship Milcom, who, that's another name for Molech, the god who you killed your children to sacrifice to him. They would worship him as well. They would worship the astral deities of the Assyrian and Canaanite gods. They would adopt all of these foreign practices. So essentially, they were patronizing God. Because here's something we have to get. Worshiping God and something else is not worshiping God at all. It is patronizing him. Right? Saying, yeah, God, we'll worship you. Settle down. But then turning around and worshiping a whole bunch of other things, that's not actually worship of God. You're just patronizing him. It would be the same thing. Like, think of it from a human perspective. If I told my wife, like, I love you, honey, but I'm going to go sleep with a whole bunch of other women, she would go, you don't actually love me. Oh, no, I do. But I just want to go and sleep with a whole bunch of other women. I still love you. That's essentially what they're doing to God. Yeah, God. Yahweh, we'll worship you, but we also want to worship all of these other things, right? So it's just a blatant patronizing of God, and it really, it breaks the first commandment. If you remember the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, you shall have no other gods before me, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that's in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. So God, like the first commandment, God says, you shall not worship other things in the sky, in the earth, in the water. Don't worship anything else. And so the Israelites had said, okay, we'll worship you, but we also want to worship these other things. So they were patronizing God. Secondly, the Israelites were neglecting God. Verse 6 says, those who have turned back from following the Lord, who do not seek the Lord or inquire of him. So verse 6 is really straightforward. The people had turned their backs on God. They weren't seeking him. They weren't inquiring of him. And here's the thing. The Israelites, they were meant to. They were meant to seek God. They were supposed to inquire of his ways. It was meant to be this, okay, God, what would you have us do? God, what should we do in this situation? I mean, a perfect example of this is King David. Verse after verse after verse shows us that David, for the most part, inquired of the Lord, sought direction from him. He didn't make a move until God told him to. 1 Samuel 23. Then David inquired of the Lord again, and the Lord answered him. 1 Samuel 30, David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue after this band? 2 Samuel 2, after this, David inquired of the Lord, shall I go up into the cities of Judah? 2 Samuel 5, and David inquired of the Lord, shall I go up against the Philistines? See, this is how a life of following God is supposed to look like. Like, think about everything David did for the most part. David, God, should I pursue after that band? And God would answer him. God, should I go up to the cities of Judah? And God would answer him. God, should I go against the cities of Philistine? And God would answer him, seeking God's counsel, inquiring of the Lord for every decision you make. I mean, it reminds me of Proverbs 3. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Trust in the Lord. Acknowledge God. Don't lean on your own understanding, in your ability to choose right from wrong. But that's exactly what the people of Judah were doing. They were neglecting God. They were not inquiring of him. They weren't seeking after him. They had turned their backs on him. Maybe they thought, you know, we can figure it out on our own. Maybe they believed that they were smarter than God. Who knows? The text simply tells us that they no longer sought God. And so because of their neglect of God, God says, I am coming in judgment. So they were patronizing God, they were neglecting God. And finally, in verse 12, we see the people trivializing God. It says, at that time I will search Jerusalem with lamps, and I will punish the men who are complacent, those who say in their hearts, Lord will not do good, nor will he do ill. So not only were they worshiping other gods, right? Sure, God will worship you, but we're also going to worship Molech and Asherah and all these other astral deities. Not only were they neglecting God, turning their backs on him, But they were also trivializing God with this attitude of complacency, saying, God's not really going to do good or bad. God's not going to do anything. And so here you have the Israelites, God's chosen people. They're not denying God's existence, but they're just denying his ongoing activity in their blessing or punishing. They're just going, God's not going to do bad or good. God's not going to do anything. Right? Sure, he exists, but he's not active. He's not engaged with what's going on. Now, the word complacent is actually really interesting in the original language. Some of your Bibles might have a footnote that says in Hebrew, are thickening on the dregs. So when verse 12 says, I will punish the men who are complacent, literally it says, I will punish the men who are thickening on the dregs. Which you go, what on earth does that mean? It is referring to the wine-making process. And in the wine-making process, fermented wine that was still kind of fermenting and turning into wine, it had to be poured from one vessel to another, often. And then there would be a screen and you would drain out, or you would screen out the sediment or any like little floaties or whatever. And so you would do that often. You would pour your wine from one vessel into another. Now, that sediment was called the dregs. And if wine was allowed to sit for too long, if you forgot to kind of pour it back and forth, it would start to thicken and it would form a really hard crust. And then that wine would become this syrupy, bitter, unpalatable substance. And really, you would ruin your entire batch of wine. So God is comparing the Israelites to that. He says, you guys are complacent. You've just been sitting around for too long, right? God is saying you are hard and crusty and bitter and good for nothing, really. You can't drink that. It's useless now. And so really what that means is that the Israelites were becoming hard and indifferent towards God. And you kind of get that sense. Yeah, God's not going to do good or bad. They were just they didn't care anymore. They thought that their prosperity and success was from their own doing. And so they became lazy and arrogant, and they said, you know what? God exists, but he's not active in our lives. He's not going to do bad or good. We are the ones who decide. So you see in chapter 1, because of these things, the day of the Lord, the invasion from Babylon, the destruction of Jerusalem, and their exile was coming because they patronized God, because they neglected him, and because they trivialized him. And then we won't spend a ton of time, but that's why you'll read, you know, from verses 10 on, this description of the destruction. You know, the fish gate, the second quarter, mortar, all of these neighborhoods will be destroyed, and their goods will be plundered, and their houses will be destroyed. And then verse 14, you know, it's near, it's hastening fast, it's bitter, and there's the sound of trumpet blasts and battle cries, and just describing this terrible day when Babylon would invade. So the question then for you and I is, can we be guilty of doing the same thing? Right? Do you and I patronize God? Do we neglect him? Do we trivialize him? And I think, yes, there is a tendency for all of us human beings to do this. Because of our sinful nature, I think if we're not careful, we can fall into the very same pattern that Israel was in. And I remember early on in my Christian life, reading the story of Israel and thinking, like, man, you dummies, why can't you get this? And now, having followed Jesus for like 20 years, I'm like, yeah, I'm exactly the same. I'm no different than the Israelites. So I think if we're not careful, we can very easily patronize God. Like the Israelites worshiped God, but they also worshiped the God of the Assyrians, the God of the Canaanites, Asherah, Molech. But so the names of our false gods might be different. But I think that all of us, we worship things besides God. We don't call our idols Molech or Baal or Asherah. But we all have idols that we turn to, and we all have gods that we worship. And in that way, I think we're very much like the Israelites. We worship God. We go, yep, God, I'm going to worship you, but I'm also going to worship money or sex or power or status or comfort, or I'll worship myself, or I'll worship my relationships. I mean, really, there is no end to the number of idols that we can have in our lives. I think John Calvin said, the heart is an idol factory. Like, it's our sinful, fallen nature. We just constantly produce idols. Because here's the thing, every human being is a worshiper. We were designed to worship. And really, before the fall, we were designed to worship God, but since the fall, we just begin to worship other things. We're always worshiping something. But you need to hear this, worshiping God and worshiping something else is not worshiping God at all. You are patronizing him. Right? Worshiping God on a Sunday and then spending the rest of your week bowing down to the idol of sex or money or power or fame, you're not actually worshiping God at all. Right? So don't fool yourself where we go, yeah, I have all these idols, but at least I came on Sunday and worshiped God. He's not really impressed with that. Right? You're just patronizing him, just like the Israelites were. So we come and I can worship God on a Sunday, and then maybe I overwork the entire week because I want to make as much money as I can. And I stress about how much money is in the bank because in reality I'm worshiping money. Or I come and I worship God, but then I go home and I have unrealistic expectations of entitlement or materialism because in reality I just worship comfort all week long. Or I worship God and yet I go home and then I have unrealistic expectations of sex, or I'm addicted to pornography because I actually worship sex instead of worshiping God. So I think we need to be very wary of this, that we don't fool ourselves like the Israelites did that said, yeah, it's fine. God is fine if I worship him, but then I also worship these other things. That is not worship of God. That is patronizing him. And so we need to guard ourselves because human beings, we are so quick to do this. You know, something catches our eye and our worship just so quickly goes to created things. So I think we also need to be on guard against the neglect of God. Verse 6 tells us the Israelites had turned their back on following him. They didn't seek the Lord. They didn't inquire of him. And I think, again, there's a tendency for us to do this as well. You and I were meant to live in relationship with God, to seek him, to inquire of him, to depend on him, to lean on him, to not seek our own understanding or our own will, but seek him. Like, really, in every situation in life, whether it's your job or money or your family, every aspect of life, if you're a follower of Jesus, is meant for us to be going to God and saying, God, I want to think like you would about this situation. God, I want to speak the words that you would speak into this situation, at my job, in my family life. God, I want to do what you would do in this situation. I want to work at my job the way you would. It's this idea of every aspect of life just living in dependence on him. But here's the thing. I think our temptation is, we live in an individualistic, autonomous society, and our society and much of our lives is, you know, I can do it on my own. I can figure it out. And if we're not careful, we kind of live as, I've heard the phrase, we live as functional atheists, where we say, yeah, 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 I believe in God, but then you just spend your life not ever thinking about what he would do in that situation. I mean, I'm so guilty of this. I do this. A problem comes my way, or a decision, and then I go, okay, now if I did that, then that would happen, and okay, I got to be smart about this, and then sometimes I stop and I go, man, I haven't even prayed about this yet, right? We do this, where the first thing should be, okay, God, what would you do in this situation? Give me wisdom, God. Now, here's what I don't mean. I don't mean, like, don't go overboard. I don't mean that, God, what cereal would you have me eat this morning? That's not what I'm talking about, right? You and I, we make decisions, right? But listen, so many of us, I mean, we move into a new house in a new neighborhood, and we don't even think, God, where would you have me live where I can be on mission for you? All we care about is, well, is there enough square footage? Does it have granite countertops? Like really, when we should be saying, God, which neighborhood would you have me live in so that I can advance your kingdom? Right? We do that. So to think about these decisions that we make, don't neglect God in those decisions. We are meant to actually live in dependence on Him. Lastly, I think that we can also trivialize God. The Israelites were very complacent. They said, you know what? God's not going to do good or evil. God's not going to do anything. And they were actually quite proud of their prosperity because they believed, this is my own doing. And so they trivialized God by thinking, well, God's not really involved in our lives. And I think we can do the same thing, right? God doesn't really care what I do. He doesn't care about my job. He doesn't care how I raise my kids. He doesn't care how I spend my money. You know, some of us might have that view. Well, if God exists, He's kind of up there in heaven or wherever He is, and He's not involved in the details. And that would be a wrong view. God is incredibly involved in the details of your life. And so we got to be careful that we don't become complacent, that you and I don't thicken on the dregs, right? That we don't become just lazy and complacent where we go, God's not going to do one thing or the other. He's not involved at all. So, I mean, the Israelites were patronizing God, neglecting God, and trivializing God. And God says in verse 17, I will bring distress on mankind so that they shall walk like the blind, because they have sinned against the Lord. And really, that is the case of every human being since the beginning. Since the fall, when the first human beings rebelled against God, they wanted to decide good and evil for themselves, and they chose to disobey, and they plunged all of creation, including every human being, into darkness, spiritual blindness. And that's us. All human beings are born blind to the truth. And it's as if we're stumbling around with our eyes closed, trying to figure out which way to go. And so here then comes the good news of the gospel, because God says in Zephaniah, I'm going to bring distress on mankind so that they're going to walk around like blind people because of their sin and rebellion. And then in Luke chapter 4, a man named Jesus stands up in a synagogue and he cites a prophecy from Isaiah, and that prophecy in Isaiah is about this great overturn, this great reversal of blindness. So Jesus says this in Luke 4, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because He's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And he rolled up the scroll and he gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. See, because of sin, all of humanity, you and I, were walking around blind, patronizing God, neglecting Him, trivializing Him. And then Jesus comes and He begins His ministry by saying, God has anointed me to give sight to the blind. And listen, absolutely, Jesus healed many physically blind people in His ministry, but it goes so much deeper than that. John 8:12, again, Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. John 9, Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. So Jesus multiple times said, I'm here because I'm the light of the world and I'm here to cure your blindness. So those who don't see will see, and those who do see and think that they've got it all figured out without me, Jesus says, you're going to become blind. So Jesus came to give sight to the spiritually blind so that we don't have to stumble around in the darkness. Jesus came and He lived a perfect life, and He went to the cross for all of our rebellion. Jesus died for all of your sin, for all of your patronizing of God, for all of my neglect of God, for all of our trivializing God. So when you surrender to Jesus and you confess and you repent and turn to Him, it's like He removes those spiritual blinders and you begin to see God for who He truly is and who you truly are. And I think the more that you understand the gospel, and the more that you spend time in his word, and the more that you treasure Jesus, the harder it will be to patronize him. The harder it will be to neglect him, and the harder it will be to trivialize him. The more that you treasure Jesus, and that your eyes are open to the wonders of the gospel, it'll be harder and harder for you to go, yeah, I'll worship you, God, but I also want to worship the other things. It'll become harder for you to go, yeah, I'm going to make a whole bunch of decisions and I don't even care what God thinks. It'll become harder for you to trivialize God and think that he's not involved the more that you understand the gospel. So I would encourage you to continue to meditate on the gospel, to continue to spend time in the word, that your eyes would be opened and that you would treasure Jesus more and more and more. I'm reminded of a song that my wife sings to our kids every night. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. And that's a great song, but it's also amazingly true. If you actually turn your eyes to Jesus and gaze at what he's done and look at the gospel, then the things of earth just kind of grow dim in the light of Jesus' glory and his grace towards you. So Jesus, I just thank you for your word. I thank you for the book of Zephaniah and just the warnings that are in this first chapter. God, we can be very much like the Israelites, where we patronize you by worshiping you and yet worshiping so many other things. We can neglect you by just going about our day and not inquiring of you or seeking your counsel or direction. And I know that I can be guilty of trivializing you, where I go, yeah, God doesn't really care. He's not that involved. He's not going to do good or bad. And so, God, just forgive us. I pray that we would be people who just so treasure the gospel, that as our minds grow in our knowledge of who you are and what you've done, that these other things would just fade away, that it would become harder and harder to patronize you, that we go, why would I want to worship all these other things when I get to worship the creator of the universe, it would become harder to neglect you, that our go-to would just be to inquire of you often. God, what would you do in this situation? God, give me wisdom for my job or my family or my house or my money. God, give me much wisdom, that it would become harder and harder to neglect you. So God, would you just do that work in our hearts, that daily we would just grow more and more in love with you and treasure you, Jesus. And ultimately, I thank you, Jesus, that you have done what none of us could do, that you came to open the eyes of spiritually blind people, pay for their sin, and free them so that we can worship you, holy Jesus. Thank you for who you are and what you've done. And so we just pray all of this in your name. Amen.